Welcome to episode 204 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and joining me is H.B. Lyle to talk about The Year of the Gun, his third crime fiction novel featuring Wiggins, who was, in his youth, Sherlock Holmes's irregular in chief. Ben, thanks for joining me again.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We last spoke 2 years ago in 2018 when The Red Ribbon, the second in your series, was published. At the end of the story, Wiggins was done with dealing with Vernon Tell, his boss at the newly minted MI5, domestic surveillance, and armed with the knowledge that no matter what he accomplished, he was done with being stuck at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. So he decided to look for the love of his life in New York and book passage on the Titanic. What could go wrong? But what? But you'll tell us what happened after that.
I don't want to spoil too much, but yes, he basically gets into the equivalent of a barroom brawl on the underdecks of the Titanic, a gambling scuffle, and he ends up being thrown off the ship. On the last stop before it goes off into the North Atlantic and its doom. And its last stop is Queenstown, as was, which is now sort of Cork Harbour. And so he ends up in Dublin, Ireland, which was then not even part of the British Empire, part of Great Britain.
So that gets him to Dublin. And, I think for Americans and for the English and for those in the United Kingdom, for such a small island, Ireland looms large in our shared history and our separate histories. And Wiggins finds himself in Dublin and he falls in with a criminal element. And the line between criminality and politics is porous in this time before Ireland's revolution, because revolutionaries want guns, which are difficult to obtain, and criminals want to sell revolutionaries' guns in order to make money. And Wiggins still wants to pay for his passage to New York. So this sort of puts him in a tricky kind of place.
I think obviously it's an interesting point you make about the sort of lines between criminality and politics, but I think those lines are still blurred still even today, because they're blurred in particularly in anywhere that's subjugated or colonized. If the government is an enemy that you have no power in changing, then of course the people who want to fight that are criminals anyway.
And there's always a little bit of, I'm bringing up the American angle because I could be wrong, but somewhere between 25% and 40% of Americans, and this includes my husband and my daughter, are of Irish descent. And there was a lot of sort of romanticized sympathy among Irish descendants in the United States. So this romanticized kind of feeling, as well as the criminal element looking at it and saying, we can make money with this because guns were much easier to obtain in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, again, going back to the element which I didn't address in your first question, but you just reminded me of, but yeah, the Ireland, particularly in this sort of Anglo-American story, the Irish diaspora is huge, and Ireland punches well above its weight, I think, in terms of its influence, certainly in American life particularly. And also, to shift the focus slightly, in the English literature, which is something, obviously, that Britain shares with America and with the Commonwealth, etc. Dublin is the only city in the world that has three Nobel laureates, for example, won the Nobel Prize for Literature, and they're three of not the most famous writers from Dublin. Dublin in particular, but Ireland in general, it's a massive part of English literature. you know, some of the greatest writers, greatest poets, greatest playwrights, Oscar Wilde, James Joyce, obviously Samuel Beckett, George Bernard Shaw, they're all Irishmen.
Oh, the list could go on. Yeats,
Seamus Heaney, I think he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. I think he's the latest one to win it. But, a massive, considering, as you say, that it's a much smaller place than you might think, judging by those markers. And again, sort of updating it to that American link, it does go back to the Irish Republican Army, for example, the Republican movement in Ireland does have great connections, for good or bad, with a lot of America, especially the northeast of the United States, because that was where money was available. And, you know, Irish-American people, if nothing else, you know, they lived in a land free of the crown, free of Great Britain, thanks to, you know, the War of Independence, etc.
We call it the Revolutionary War on this side of the pond.
Yeah. That's like they do in India. In English, British history, they call the 1857, they call it the Great Indian Mutiny, the Great Mutiny. And obviously in India, they call it the First War of Independence. So
it's history is subjective. And depending on who happens to be writing the text, you're going to, just as a little digression, and because we're in a political season here in the United States, what I call the Civil War, being a Northerner, is still called the War of Northern Aggression or the War Between the States, south of the Mason-Dixon line in the southern part of the United States. So it's also a point that a lot of these battles never really end.
I know, it's shocking. I've been trying to write a piece actually about the aftermath of I would call it the American Civil War myself, but yeah, the aftermath of that, a historical piece for television, but it's the resonances with today, you know, a lot of those views never went away, or the kind of people that held those rather abhorrent views are still there.
It's a difficult thing, but you know that there are still, to switch it back to England, there's still hard feelings against the Irish and the IRA. They filter through generations. A friend of mine from London, is still, there's a lot of animus there. A friend of hers was blown up, and she feels, she still feels it, even now that the so-called troubles are in the rearview mirror. And what we're seeing in your book is sort of the troubles brewing and all the different factions and how Wiggins has to sort of tiptoe among and between them.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. And I take your point as well. I mean, I was woken up once in the middle of the night by an IRA bomb, massive bomb. So it woke us all up in the house. It was nowhere near. It was just so big that it was like 1 o'clock in the morning. That was sort of the back end of it. Absolutely, people, you know, that isn't something that's died from either side either. You know, it's only recently that the British government gave an apology for shooting lots of innocent people in the 1970s. And then the British government even now are trying to reignite problems on the border by the madness of Brexit.
Yeah, that's. But you know, I could go down this primrose path really easily.
Yeah.
I think a lot of what you write about in the book shows the origin story, not necessarily for Brexit, although maybe kind of sort of, because there is a little soupçon of the Brits worried that the Germans might get involved, because this is the run-up this is the run-up to World War One, and that's what Vernon Kell, in your previous book, that's what Vernon Kell was very, very concerned with, was the German infiltration of Britain.
That's absolutely true, that the Germans would have been happy to see the Irish fight the British on the island of Ireland. But I think, yes, to go back to your point, I think that I did want to show a little bit. Obviously, the book isn't about the Irish Troubles, but it is about the time, you know, as you said, that they're brewing there. And you see, because looking at it from now, it's like, oh, why did all that start? What is Northern Ireland compared to the Republic of Ireland? And, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, of course, the book is set essentially nine years before the creation of two separate entities on the island of Ireland. So, you know, the Republic, well, not, it wasn't the Republic but first, but the separation that we now know was agreed 9 years after this book is set. And so I wanted to show that that was what was happening.
One of the things I noticed, and I saw this in the previous two installments of this story, is everyone in the Year of the Gun is seeking something, including Sherlock Holmes, who makes contact with Wiggins in New York. And I thought it was intriguing how the individual agendas and odysseys of the characters sort of aligned at times and collided at times. And this is a little bit of a technical question, was how did you weave all of this together? I know you were a screenwriter. Was it cards on a corkboard, or did the story come into your head as a continuation of the Red Ribbon, you know, fully formed?
No, it wasn't fully formed, but in a way that I didn't do for the first book, The Irregular, or really for The Red Ribbon. I did write a document for this book before I started writing the actual manuscript. So by a document, I mean like a sort of short couple of pages, kind of a synopsis, partly because my publisher wanted a synopsis, so whatever his reasons were, I can't remember. So I sort of knew what it was going to be about. I definitely wanted to send him to Ireland, because I thought it was really interesting, you know, what was going on there then. And I was desperate to send him to New York, because I love New York. And then I had an idea, the idea tying all the whole thing together. So the grand architecture of it, I had in a sort of two or three page document. And then, because I knew that after the Red Ribbon, that kind of has three points of view and almost three storylines that come together, I wanted this book to be a bit more sort of about Wiggins and his journey. And so for any of your listeners that have read the previous books, there's a bit less of Vernon Kell in this one, of Wiggins's boss, and more of sort of Wiggins on his mission.
Well, I don't think it's a spoiler to say, because you just mentioned it, that Wiggins finally gets to New York in the company of Irish criminals. And I found his observations, the writing you wrote of his observations, he finds a familiar sort of grinding poverty with its fellow travelers of domestic abuse, hunger, and exploitation. But maybe the only bright spot is that the poor seem to lack the hopeless downtroddenness of their counterparts in England and Ireland. And they walk around with something akin to optimism, for want of a better word. And, you know, it's something like hope. And you wrote the most amazing sentence, and I'm going to quote, "He didn't think he could feel like that again. That's what shocked him, that his heart still worked, like it worked when he was a kid, like all our hearts are born to work, as a vessel for love, a generator for love, until life's reverses clog up the system, the pain blocking the emotion, until it just beats and beats and beats until it beats no more." I mean, that's just amazing. And I to me, that was it just jumped off of the page, and it kind of seemed to me that that was a little bit what Wiggins' literal and metaphorical journey in New York sort of, it was a description of it.
Well, I'm glad you like it. Yeah, I mean, I obviously don't want to spoil too much what that's in reference to, but...
Oh, no, we won't. We don't have to mention what it's in reference to, but I think it's a sentence that could have been in reference to more than one thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, well, so I think that captures a bit of it. I tried to get, there's a bit in other places as well, because obviously that sort of sentiment there is... applies to more than one thing, but to talk about that in a wider sense, his attitude to, I mean, he only knows New York, as do I, really. I don't really know the rest of America other than through, you know, various media. I've only ever been to New York in the States, but I've been there twice. I really love it. But I gave to Wiggins some of my sentiments about America, at least historical. I think America, unfortunately, isn't quite what it was in these aspects. And that hopefulness and that, it was created by hopeful people. And by hopeful people, I mean immigrants who are traveling there for a better life and have that attitude to life. And then they get to somewhere that offered them an opportunity for a better life in the way that they didn't have in the old world, you know, in the structures of the Europe, both Eastern and Western Europe at the time. And I think at another point, he kind of looks at the people who are no richer than him or the poor people that he knew back in the old empire who walk around differently, as if they have some ownership of those streets.
And it's a place where hustlers can transcend almost any background to, you know, walk amongst whoever they want to walk amongst. And I think that, especially in the time period that you're writing about, the second decade of the 20th century is absolutely true.
And it's one of the best things about the place. That's that, you know, obviously we don't want to encourage hucksters and hustlers, but we do want to encourage that kind of openness.
Well, once again, it's a weird time to be talking about hucksters and hustlers. In the context of a historical novel, it's something that he observes, he's hanging with the criminal element. He observes that there are criminal gangs that are nativist, you know, native born Americans. There are the Irish, which he has a lot to do with. There's also the Italian gangs and the Jewish gangs. And he sort of runs into characters that represent all of them. You know, some of them are famous gangsters of the period. I'm not going to spoil anything because I thought that was just sort of an amazing, like, oh my God. This is something that, you know, I could see Wiggins sort of fitting right in.
I mean, in a weird way, I mean, who knows where he's going to go, but yes, I think one of the characters in the book kind of says that to Wiggins. I don't think it spoils it well to say who it is, because it's not a major, but Rothstein.
Right. Okay. That's who I was thinking. And I'm thinking a lot of Rothstein because the World Series are on right now in the United States.
Okay. Yeah.
Whenever I think of baseball, I think of Rothstein. So
yes, your mind always runs to crime.
I can't help it. It's an occupational hazard.
But yeah, I think Rothstein even says that to him. It's like, you know, you're going to be back here. And I don't have a specific storyline in mind, but that is one of the things that is, and certainly was, and is great about New York, is that in the society of the time in the UK, Wiggins would always hit a ceiling. You know, he'd hit a class ceiling that he couldn't break, you know.
Well, and that was his frustration in the Red Ribbon, where, you know, he was so much more talented than any of the sort of better class of men that other services like the MI6 service wanted to hire. He just literally, once again, literally, figuratively, and metaphorically ran rings around them. As a matter of fact, the only person that sort of saw, you know, Cal certainly saw his worth, but didn't see him any higher than what he was at the time. And I think that was, to me, that's something that's so appealing about Wiggins, is he's enlightened enough to see where he is on this ladder, and that the ladder just stops for him. It doesn't matter how good he is. He could save the bloody British Empire and nothing would change. And I think that seems, you know, that I think that's the thing that bothers him the most about working for Vernon Cal and, you know, and continuing in that sort of in that career path.
Well, absolutely. And that wouldn't have necessarily been the case in New York, although obviously if he'd worked for Rothstein, then he'd been on the wrong side of the law. But I could always send him over to fix the World Series in 1919.
Well, it's interesting that you bring it up, because the press materials indicated that the Year of the Gun is the culmination of the series. And I can see that, but I also could have seen Higgins continue, and I would have loved to have seen him back in London in the 30s tackling Mosby and his ilk. So is it the conclusion of the series? If it is, how does a writer approach that? I've spoken to other writers about the sort of the culmination of their series. It's a interesting, you know, would you miss the characters, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, personally, you see, because I wrote it, and I never I don't think of it as the culmination.
So, thank God.
And then I wrote it, and the kind of copy editor thought it was, and like, oh, you know, given the ending is sort of...
Well, that, you know, without talking about the ending, it could go either way.
Yeah, but I never had that in my mind that I was... ending the series particularly.
Because the end of the Red Ribbon, I think, and when we spoke 2 years ago, you told me he went on the Titanic. Well, it would have been a very, very short book if he had continued on the boat all the way to New York.
So. Yeah, absolutely. That's obviously interesting. And, you know, people have written about that as well. No, I hope it's not. There's certainly other ideas. I mean, I'm sort of working on a sort of historical crime thriller, crime sort of spy thriller, rather, set in the 1920s, in the early 1920s in London. It doesn't star Wiggins, but that doesn't mean that I don't want to write more about him.
So that was actually going to be my next question. If Higgins is going to, you know, sort of stay with you, but, you know, kind of chill for a little while, what are you working on? And of course, the 1920s in London this whole period was so fascinating, you know, in the wake of the Russian Revolution and all sort of this wave that was sweeping across Europe in the wake of World War I, it really changed the world.
Well, absolutely. And the story that I'm sort of writing now, I don't want to say too much because it's kind of early days, but the culmination of that story is about the greatest piece of, the most influential piece of fake news in history. That was fake news probably trumped up by MI5, by the British Secret Service. They forged a letter and then got one of the newspapers to publish it to queer an election.
No.
They didn't like who was going to win, so they forged something and published it, and in order to let, you know, make their guys win the election.
There is nothing new, is there?
No. And then this story is about a character who, a young man who gets sort of a friendly uncle's type figure, gets him a job at a new company in 1922, just a startup company called the British Broadcasting Company.
Oh, yeah, heard of it.
Yeah. Well, it changed, obviously, a few years later into the British Broadcasting Corporation, but yes, the BBC. And it's about the intersection of media, politics, the security services, and essentially the, you know, the truth and what people decide is the truth. And that age, it really is an age of extremes. You know, it's like fascism and communism. It essentially pick a side and the truth is up for grabs. And hopefully we're not quite in that space yet, because we all know what happened 15 years later, but in the 20s, I mean, you know, what we all know mm-hmm. about the 30s, but there's lots of similarities there, you know, and the music's great, there's jazz and all that kind of stuff. So that's the sort of area I'm writing about now, but I wanted a different character to do that with rather than Wiggins.
I think historical fiction and historical crime fiction can be very, very instrumental in showing us, showing readers stories and reasons. And, you know, I think of James Benn, who writes a World War II mystery series about a character called Billy Boyle. And, of course, Alan First writes about World War II, and Charles Todd about the post-World War I. And a lot of what, you know, and what you're talking about with this new novel sounds very much like the origin story for what we're enduring now.
Well, I mean, you can always look at it like that. That's how you try to write them anyway, to point out those things, ignore the history that doesn't quite fit the theory.
Well, I have to ask you, you know, you're a UK-based writer, you're launching the Year of the Gun. It's in the Sherlockian universe, and I'm sure under other circumstances you would be going to bookstores and perhaps crime writing festivals and the like, and my guess is you're not doing that. So what mechanism are you, other than talking to me, are you doing in the public, you know, the publicizing the launch of your book?
Right, yes, so I'm not doing any of those things you talked about. No, we're living a restricted life, as are you, I'm sure. I'm probably going to be more restricted even than that soon. So no launch party. Yeah, so I'm doing a few bits, writing a piece for Crime Reads, which your listeners probably know that site in the States. Somewhere else I can't remember in America. And then I'm doing a blog tour and just bits of, and I've written a few pieces for some websites here on a character called Erskine Childers, and something about a character who appears in the book called Charles Becker and stuff like that. So the life of the sort of literary life is as restricted as most of our lives are at the moment.
Exactly. But, you know, let's hope for better days with your next book, and hopefully we can go back to crime writing festivals, although the news from Harrogate is not good.
No. I mean, the earliest that all that's going to happen is next summer, but That's kind of dependent either on a therapeutic breakthrough or a vaccine breakthrough.
Well, here's hoping for happier days. And, you know, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about the Year of the Gun. And, you know, I get a chance to tell you what just a really cracking good story it is.
Yes, thank you for that. So obviously we have these chats and we all talk about the seriousness of the history and all what it means, but I always try and write a page-turning tale first and foremost, and then, you know, bubble the history up beneath that.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking to you about your next book, someday meeting you at a festival and getting you to drag all my books with me so you can sign them.
Oh, well, of course, yeah. Absolutely.
Okie doke. I will talk to you hopefully next year.
Thanks for this, Nancy. I really enjoyed that.
All right.
Have a good day, afternoon, evening, and fingers crossed for November 3rd.
Yes.